Let us now take some time and discuss some common stock characteristics, with an emphasis on dividends. Slide number 61, a stock spin-off. What is a stock spin-off? Well, that's a conversion of one of a firm's subsidiaries to a standalone company by distribution of stock in that new company to existing shareholders. So the company is saying, hey, it makes sense for us to split into two or three parts. And you, as a shareholder of the original company, get to keep your shares, but then you get shares in the new company or companies. Sometimes the new company is still majority owned by the company that spun it off. You see, they're not dumb. If they see their young child going off into the world, but they see very good things for it, they'll hang on to quite a bit of the stock. Recently, Kraft, you've heard of them? They were spun off by Altria. Altria, who, that's the name for Philip Morris. They changed their name, I don't know, about 10, 12 years ago. And they owned Kraft, and they owned Miller. They spun that off, but they still own quite a bit of that company. And why did they do that? Why did they spin off Kraft? Well, there were many people who just simply will never buy a tobacco company. But here was a tobacco company that owned the world's second largest food company at the time. And so they said, well, this is kind of limiting ourselves. Let's spin off Kraft so that people who don't have a problem buying food companies can buy it. They then, Altria, divested themselves of the international tobacco business. And that company is now called Philip Morris International. And to give you an idea of how topsy-turvy the world is, Philip Morris International is based in the United States, but sells cigarettes outside the United States. Altria is the company that sells the cigarette, the Marlboro, in the United States. Plus, Kraft has now spun off, I have a hard time, it looks French, it looks Mondelez, but they pronounce it Mondelez. And that's the company that now runs all the snack foods, like Oreos and Triscuits and the thing. So, oh my goodness, it gets crazy. The history of spinoffs has been checkered. Some spinoffs have done better than the companies that spun them off. And a tremendous example of this are the Baby Bells. Many of you, before you were born, don't know this before you, because it happened before you were born. But AT&T used to be one big company, the telephone company here in the United States. And in 1984, they broke it up, and we had AT&T and all the Baby Bells. The Baby Bells were Pacific Bell and Bell South and Ameritech and what was the one that became Verizon? Bell Atlantic and the one that became AT&T, the new AT&T, was called SBC Communications. And what happened is they started buying each other up, and now we basically have two of the original Baby Bells who have gotten huge. That's Verizon and SBC Communications. And SBC Communications got so big that they bought AT&T, the old AT&T, just to grab the name. Believe that. Anyway, figure that one. Now, some spinoffs have not done so well. Coca-Cola Enterprises, which was spun off from Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola Enterprises is the company that actually bottles the Coke. They don't make the Coke, they bottle it. And Lucent Technologies, which was used to be called Western Electric, Bell Labs, they were part of AT&T, and they were spun off from AT&T, and they've been examples both of disappointments. So often they do well, but sometimes not so well. A stock split on slide 62. Now, this is important, folks, because there's a little bit of intrigue going on here. A stock split is a maneuver in which a company increases the number of shares outstanding by exchanging a specified number of new shares of stock for each outstanding share. So there are lots of different stock splits, but two for one is typical. You have 100 shares, and one day you wake up and you now have 200 shares. Yippee! No, no, no. the price went down from $20 to $10. So sure, you're getting more shares, but the price just goes down commensurate. Did I say that right? Commensurate with the number of shares that you, additional shares that you received. And there are 3-for-1 splits, 3-for-2 splits, 1-for-5 splits, you know, a reverse split it's called. Just simply put, there is no increased value from stock splits. If you had one share at $20, you now have two shares at $10, the value is still $20. It is a psychological increase at best. And there used to be a technological reason, a reason to have the stock split, just because it made trading in 100 share increments easier, and that's when people did face-to-face trading, but we don't do face-to-face trading anymore. It's all electronic, so what do you care? The answer is you don't. And the sage of Omaha, Warren Buffett, since the 1960s, has always thought that this was an accounting gimmick that he really disliked. So he refused to split his stock, Berkshire Hathaway. Since its inception, he has refused to split the stock. And subsequently, a single share now goes for around $145,000. And you say, oh my goodness. That's outrageous. But no, that's typical. If GE or Coca-Cola or these other long-standing, large companies that have been around for decades and will continue to be around for decades, if they had refused to split their stock since their inception, a single share would go for whatever, $100,000 or whatever. So you, we will see fewer and fewer splits now because of there's not the need to do it for technology. Sometimes you see a company split their stock. At least this is what I think. I don't know if I'm right, but it sure seems that way. When they believe that things are looking good and they're trying to tell the world that, yeah, we things are looking pretty good for us. Now, why did they split the stock? To do that. And why don't they just come out and say, things are looking good? Because, Reg, you know why. Because if they say, things are looking good, and then they don't turn out so well, they can get sued by ambulance chasing lawyers saying, you told these people you were trying to deceive them, we're going to sue you, pay us $100,000 to go away. So they will split the stock as a way of saying, you know, things are looking pretty good for us. I noticed that happened a few years ago with Qualcomm. They split the stock for no apparent reason. I mean, it didn't need to. It wasn't even trading that high. And then it turned out that the next few years, Qualcomm did pretty well. They were internationally increasing their market share and the like outside the United States. Did very well for themselves. So watch for those stock splits. But remember, they don't mean anything. But do you have to understand them? Yes, you do. Right. You now have a 2-for-1 split. You now have twice as many shares at half the price. Slide number 63, Treasury stocks. What is nothing to do with the United States Treasury, folks, or Treasury bonds or anything like that. Treasury stocks are shares of stock that have been sold and subsequently repurchased by the issuing firm. They're sometimes called share buybacks or just simply buybacks. And share buybacks reduce the number of outstanding shares. Now, why would a company want to do this? Well, the logic being that after the buyback, there is less supply of outstanding stock. Right. Existing shareholders now have a larger percentage ownership of the corporation. Exactly. And you econ students, what happens when you reduce the supply of a certain item? Assuming the demand doesn't change, the price should rise. Exactly. During the run-up of the 1990s, share buybacks were often seen as a better alternative to dividend increases. The belief was that investors were more interested in capital gains than dividends, and that buybacks increased the potential for capital gains by reducing the supply of stock. Now, in practice, does it always work that way? No! Sometimes the company, I don't know, whatever, the stock price is high already for whatever reason. The market's in a giddy state. Everybody's feeling really excited and stocks are selling at very high valuations. And so the companies buy back their shares when they're high. Does that make sense? No. So sometimes it does work and sometimes it doesn't work out so well. Slide number 64, classifications of common stock, classified common stock. Well, sometimes, especially when the company is very large, common stock will be issued by a company in different classes, each of which offers different privileges and benefits to its holder. There'll be a Class A shares, Class B shares. Sound familiar? Kind of like the mutual funds, but not exactly the same. The Class A shares of a company might be the common stock that is available to everybody, and the Class B shares might be this common stock that is only available to the family that originally owned the company and took it public. And the Class B shares might pay an enhanced dividend, but may have no voting rights. So there are all different types of combinations and permutations of this. At one time, GM, I think, had 7 different classifications. The old GM, this was several years ago. 7 different classifications of stocks. And here's an example, Berkshire Hathaway. The Class A are the original shares. Now recall, they're selling for over, whatever, $145,000 each. Well, that makes it difficult to buy a share, doesn't it, for the lowly little people like you and me. And so the financial world pressed Warren Buffett to offer a lower cost version of his stock. He didn't want to do it, but he went out, this was 20 years ago or so, and he did it, and he said, all right, we'll make a Class B shares, but they'll sell for $3,000, $3,300, which not what the Wall Street folks had in mind. In the prospectus, Buffett said he wouldn't buy them. So here's a guy who's coming out with a new classification of his company stock and telling people not to buy it. That tells you that this man is an honest man. You know, he was sort of doing it to make the investment world happy. And then it turned out that it worked out for him very well, because he wanted to use his shares as a way to buy other companies, which is typical. Companies will use their shares as a form of currency, because the thing, whatever they're worth, whatever the market is willing to pay for them. But the problem is, when you have currency that is in such huge increments, 145,000 or 34th, whatever it had gotten up to, I forget exactly what it had gotten up to, it's difficult. It's difficult to do that. It's difficult to use them, because it doesn't translate well, because you have one currency that's really huge and the other stock is much smaller. So he recently split those Class B shares 40-for-1. 40-for-1, so that he could use them as currency to buy other companies. And so now they sell for around $98 last time I checked. So he now has a stock that you and I can buy. But wait a minute, folks. Can you and I actually buy the Class A shares? It turns out we can. There are companies that have gone out and bought Berkshire Hathaway shares at 100 and whatever, 140 or whatever they are, happen to be selling at. And then if you come up with a couple $1,000, they will just simply sell you 0.05 shares. Do you understand? They will break up the shares into little bitty pieces in the thousands and sell you thousands of the shares. And they do the bookkeeping, and I'm sure they charge you for accordingly, because they're doing the work. So you can, even if the price goes way high, out of the reach of the little people, we, the little people, can still buy the shares. Slide number 65. Now, some common stock values. We will do a few calculations in Chapter 5, but the vast majority of our calculations are going to be done in Chapter 6, and we'll discuss valuation in detail when we get to Chapter 6. But what you will see are some numbers that some of which are meaningless. For example, par value. This is the stated or face value of a stock. And it might be a buck, it might be a cent. I don't really understand, to be truthful, I don't really understand why they assign this value to the shares. For me, it's fairly meaningless. What it reminds me of is the phenomenon you see with manufacturers' cents-off coupons. If you look on the back, it'll say value is 0.001 cent. And supposedly this happened because people would send in the 50-cent coupon and say, thank you for the 50 cents, send me the 50 cents. They didn't use the coupon to actually buy the product. So the company would say, well, that's not what the idea was. You're supposed to buy the product and we'll give you 50 cents off. So what they did is they put this little meaningless number on the back, 0.001 cents. So if you send them in 1,000 coupons, they'll give you a penny. So I think that's what it is. I don't really know. If anybody can tell me, I'd be happy to. It's not important. The book value, I know, this is something more important. This is the amount of shareholders' equity in a firm. It equals the amount of the firm's assets minus the firm's liability and the preferred stock, if there are any preferred stock. And so those of you in the Business 121 class, if you've taken the Business 121 class, or if you've taken accounting, you know that assets minus liabilities equals equity, is what the accountants call it. In the Business 121 class, we call it net worth. And that's what we call it in stocks. What we call it in stocks is book value. What is it worth to us on the books, right? You go in, look at the firm's assets, look at the firm's liabilities. Now, this number is reported in the media, and I ask you to look it up in Chapter 5 assignment. It's under Key Statistics if you use Yahoo, folks. And what you will find is it is almost always far less than the actual market value, the price, the prevailing market value of the security. And why is that? Why is the stock worth more in the open market trading between investors than the book value? Well, that makes perfect sense when you think about it. When you think about it, a small company such as a pizza shop or a shoe shine shop or whatever, the value of the assets minus the liabilities is normally not that big, depending on the company. It's usually, I mean, the pots and the pans, the tableware. They don't usually own the building. The pizza shop doesn't. They rent that. So doesn't it make more sense for the company to be intact than if you were to sell off all the assets, pay off the liabilities, and walk away? And that's obviously the case for the vast majority of companies. When it is not the case, when we see the book value go above the market value, that's usually a very bad sign. That means the investors don't believe that the company is worth what the assets are in what it possesses. That's a bad sign. And when that happens, often the company becomes a takeover target by corporate raiders who are happy to sell off all the assets, pay off all the liabilities, put the company out of business, and walk away with extra money in their pocket. You understand? And so that is a situation that happens rarely, but when it does happen, it gives capitalism a bad name, especially if you're an employee at the company. Because if you're an employee at a company that's been around for whatever, some of you might have heard of a company called Simplicity. The name still survives, but the company disappeared over 30 years ago. And for 150 years, this company was selling things that people needed until they didn't need it anymore. If you go into your grandmother's attic or garage or whatever, you might find a Singer sewing machine. Yeah, Singer. It was a sewing machine company. And because before the 1970s, 1980s or so, people used to make their own clothes. They would buy some clothes, but they would make their own clothes. And Simplicity was the company that sold you the patterns. Right. And they had been around forever. And now with automation, it didn't make sense for people to make their own clothes. It was just so much cheaper for the computer machines to make it and sell them to you. So Simplicity and Singer and all the companies that were associated with this technology basically were disappearing. So in the early 80s, Simplicity's market value was below its book value. And corporators swooped in, bought up enough shares to own the company, sold off the assets, paid off the liabilities, and walked away with money in their pocket. Now, how would you feel if you were an employee of that company? Or if that company were based in your town and now all those people are unemployed and that has a ripple effect on the businesses that... Exactly. And you are not happy. So you complain to your elected representatives and they say, well, we have to do something to protect these jobs. And you wait, no, you don't understand. Capitalists, the economists, the corporate raiders would tell you that company was not efficiently using society's capital well. It needed to be plowed under. It needed to be destroyed, creative destruction, and that capital released. And you say, well, I got to feed my kids, okay? Excuse me. And that is why we have unemployment insurance, folks. We want companies to be plowed under. We want that capital to be unlocked. But at the same time, we want people to be able to put food on the table. These systems that we've put in place, sometimes there are always unintended consequences, but especially when there's a prolonged downturn, as there has been the last several years, we're not using unemployment insurance as a way to pay people not to work. That's not the idea. The idea is to have that safety net so that we can put people out of work and have them find a better use for their time and a better use for the capital that was locked up. Makes sense? Okay, enough of the lecture. Oh, let's continue. Slide number 66. Dividends. Oh boy, don't we love dividends. These are shares of earnings given to stockholders. They're normally paid quarterly. In the United States and countries that were either previous colonies or had something to do with the United Kingdom, the England, they are paid quarterly. Canada, Hong Kong, Australia. Other countries will pay them semi-annually, every 6 months. Some countries pay them once a year. Yeah. So just remember that. United States and other countries associated with the UK are paid quarterly. The board of directors decides how much, if any, dividend should be paid and when to pay them. So remember, dividends are not mandatory, unlike interest payments from a bond. Right? Those are mandatory. If the bond issuer doesn't pay the bond interest, then they're in default and they could be dragged into bankruptcy court. Dividends are usually a percentage of the earnings per share. What's this earnings per share? Well, we're going to do a few little calculations, and there's a worksheet that you'll eventually do. You don't have to do the calculations. Why? Because you just look it up. It's too easy. The earnings per share are the amount of annual earnings available to common stockholders as stated on a per share basis. In other words, you buy one share, how much did that one share earn? It's easy to see that my little one share earns 50 cents. I just look it up. Or you can do the calculation. And so that allows your little one share to be thought of as its own little engine of earnings. So slide number 67. Here's an example of earnings per share. We have a company that reports net profit of $1 million. Yippee! Is that a lot of money? Well, to you and me, it's a lot of money. But is it a lot of money with regard to how many shares are outstanding? Well, we have to know that. There are 500,000 shares outstanding. So we take the earnings divided by the number of shares, $1 million of earnings divided by $500,000 shares, my apologies, and we have $2 earnings per share. Now, the board of directors might decide to pay out 50% of the earnings per share in the form of dividends. That's their decision. Therefore, each shareholder would receive a dollar dividend for each share they own. You own one share, you get a buck. You own 10 shares, you get $10. 100 shares? Exactly. 100 shares. $100. This is called the dividend payout ratio. The company is paying out 50% of their earnings to dividend shareholders in the form of dividends. And that's easy to compute, right? A dollar of dividends divided by $2 of earnings. Now, what's typical? 50% is not unusual for companies that have been around for a long time and are not growing. But companies that are growing usually are very reticent to pay out the money in dividends. Why? Because they need it to grow the company. So you'll see 50% is not unusual, 30% not unusual. It's unusual it gets over 70 or 80% unless the company just has cash coming out of their ears. They don't know what to do with it, and they've been around a long time, and they decide, okay, it's time to give it back to the owners of the company. Slide number 68, dividend yield, very important number. You're going to look up dividend yield, and we will discuss this vis-a-vis other investments. The dividend yield is a measure that relates dividends to share price and puts stock dividends on a relative percentage basis rather than an absolute dollar basis. You see, it's great to know that you're getting a buck per share, but we need to relate that to how much we had to pay for that dollar. If the stock in the previous slide that was paying a dollar dividend, if that were selling for $20, the dividend yield would be 5%. And it's a very simple calculation. And again, you don't have to do it. I'm going to ask you to do it, but you just look it up. A dollar dividend divided by $20 price, if the stock were selling for $20, that would be a 5% dividend. And why is that so important? Well, because it makes it easy to compare stocks with other income-oriented vehicles such as bonds or savings accounts. So you could say, yeah, my bond is paying me 3%, but this stock is paying me 4%. Well, what's the difference between the bond and the stock? Right, the stock dividend is optional. The company next quarter, if they're in the United States and they pay quarterly, they could just say we're not going to pay it. Whereas the bond has to continue to pay that dividend. Traditionally, and I want you to remember this, 3 to 6% was normal. That was normal. Is that normal now? No, it's about 2 to 3%. You know, in the 1990s, dividends went to 1% or less. In 2000, March of 2000, at the height of the stock bubble, they went to 1%. We're talking about the Standard & Poor's 500 now, the 500 largest companies in the United States. Some companies paid zero, some companies paid more. Dividends then went above 3% in the 2008 to 2009 turmoil, and now they're back down to just above 2% or so. But remember, some companies pay very healthy dividends, and some companies pay zero dividends. And there's always this tug of war. People love dividends. Well, not many of us. I love dividends. And other people say, no, don't pay out dividends. I want you to reinvest the money back in the company. And if you can't do that, buy back the shares. And that's because I want capital gains. I want the stock price to go up. So you see the tug of war that companies have to deal with. Slide number 69. Now, let's see if you can stick with me on this one, okay? It's a little tricky, but for the most part, it's pretty meaningless. There are important dates with regards to stocks. There's the declaration date. Now, that's the date that the board of directors declares the dividends. And they say, today we are declaring that we are going to pay dividends, you know, in a few weeks in the future. They don't do it the same day. And that's to give people opportunity to digest that information and decide if they want the dividend, they could buy the shares. If they don't want the dividend, they can sell the shares. And they declare a date of record. This is the date on which an investor must be registered shareholder of a firm to be entitled to receive the dividend. So we're going to set, I do June 18th on the next slide, I can't remember. We're going to set a certain date, and you have to be a shareholder of record to receive that dividend. Now, What's going on here? The next one is called ex-dividend date. This is 3 days before the date of record. You have to own the shares or buy the shares 3 days before the date of record. And this is the actual date that determines whether one is an official shareholder of a firm and thus eligible to receive a declared dividend. Ex-dividend is 3 days before. Now, why is that? Hang on a minute. We'll discuss that in the next slide. The last one is the payment date, and that's the actual date. That's a couple of weeks later after the date of record of which the company pays the dividend. Okay, so that's the actual date that you get the money, and that's not for a few weeks after the date of record. So now, slide number 70. Why is the ex-dividend date 3 days before the date of record? Well, that's because stock transactions close in 3 days. You buy the stock on June 15th. You actually do not get the stock until June 18th. It used to be 5 business days. Now it's 3 business days. And they could probably sometime in the future, because now everything's electronic, they'll lower it again. But it's 3 business days. You buy the stock on June 15th. You don't actually get it until June 18th. So theoretically, this is theoretically, folks, the opening share price on the ex-dividend date should reflect a drop in price commensurate. No, that should be commensurate. I got to change that. Commensurate with the amount of the dividend. I knew I didn't say it right. I did say it right the last time, but I didn't say it right this time. I had to change that. Commensurate, not commiserate, is when you sit down with somebody who just crashed their car and you say, "Ooh, I'm so sorry. I got to fix that." If there is a dollar per share dividend, the opening stock price should be reduced by a buck. You understand? Because they're going to take a dollar out of their piggy bank and send it to each shareholder that owns one share, right? So they're going to, whatever many shares they have to pay. But that doesn't really work that way, right? Because the prices are changing all the time. So this is just theoretical. Next slide, slide number 71. Don't buy the dividend is a common saying in the industry. The translation is you are often better off waiting until the ex-dividend date before buying a stock. Why? Here's the logic. Now, I'm not saying I agree with it, folks. I'm just telling you this is what you're going to hear, and this is what people are going to tell you, and then you have to decide whether or not you think it means anything. I think in the long term, it doesn't mean much of anything. But here's the logic. Dividends are taxable transactions. If you buy the dividend, you buy the stock just before the ex-dividend date, you will be responsible for paying the tax. And presumably the stock price will fall commensurate with the amount of the dividend. So you are better off waiting until after the ex-dividend date so that you will get the stock at a better price and not generate the taxable transaction. Now, sure, if you have tons of money and you're moving it around just to make money on small little movements, first of all, you're going to get killed with transaction costs, in my humble opinion, but whatever, then I guess this makes perfect sense. If you're renting the stock for a few weeks or a few months and not wanting to own the stock for 5 years or more, sure, this is good advice. But if you're the kind of person, the kind of investor that I hope you will become, that loves dividends, and thinks of it as a long-term relationship, you want to own the stock, not rent it, then this is not a big deal. Because first of all, you and I are not going to be having huge sums of money moved around. And secondly, you like dividends. If they're in a retirement account, you don't care because the IRS doesn't come calling until you retire anyway. And if it's in a Roth, then they never come calling. So there you go. So I don't think it's a big deal, but other people will. You have to decide what you think. Slide number 72. Now, this is very important, folks. If only to protect yourself against some, I shouldn't use this word, disreputable or cagey, sneaky, but you decide afterwards. Slide number 72. There are two types of dividends. Cash dividends, which is what you want. You want cash. If you remember nothing else, what you remember is you want your payments of dividends in the form of cash. They are taxable transactions, yes, but you still want your payment in the form of cash. Because there are some companies that will pay you with what are called stock dividends. This is payment of a dividend in the form of additional shares of stock. But wait a minute, all else being equal, and of course it never is, stock dividends have no value because they constitute a dilution of ownership. They're kind of like a stock split. So, for example, the board of directors declares a 10% stock dividend. For every 10 shares, you receive one extra share. Yippee! The price of the shares dropped 10%. Think of it like a stock split. But unlike a cash dividend, a stock dividend is not taxed. Well, gee, thank you very much. You're not taxing me, IRS, on something that is worthless. Isn't that kind of the IRS not to tax us on something that isn't worth anything? So do you want cash dividends or do you want stock dividends? Yes, you do. You want cash dividends. Remember that. And I do want you to remember this difference just in case somebody comes up to you and says, Hey, I just got a stock and they paid me 10% dividends. Was it in the form of cash or stock? It was in the form of stock, but it's 10%. And don't try to bring them down slowly to make them understand that they really didn't get anything. Okay. Tell them first that they didn't get taxed on it. That'll make them feel better, and then you can tell them the truth. Slide number 73. Now, this is very important, especially for us long-term buy-and-hold type investors. They are called dividend reinvestment plans, and they have great, I just love that name, DRIP. Do you want a DRIP? I think you do. These are plans in which shareholders have their cash dividends automatically reinvested into additional shares of the firm's common stock. Now, it sounds like a stock dividend. It is not. It is a cash dividend, and it is taxable. There were no additional shares that were issued. There's no dilution of ownership. The company had to go out and buy the shares on the open market to give you your, you know, whatever in the form of whatever the amount is in the form of cash. Your cash dividends in the form of shares. I'm sorry. They had to go out on the open market, buy the shares, and they didn't create new shares. They went out and bought those shares, and they gave you whatever, in terms of cash, your shares are worth. And on the website is a great example of San Diego Gas and Electric, Sempra, a dividend reinvestment plan, where you go directly to the company. Now, they don't do it. They have somebody do it for them. But you go to these large cap companies, most of them are large companies, well-established companies, and you say, I'd like to have a dividend reinvestment plan with your company. And they say, sure, here's the website. Now, we don't do it. Somebody does it on our behalf. And they will, instead of paying you dividends in the form of cash, they will reinvest that cash back in additional shares. So I want you to take a look at that. There's a commentary. DRIPs are an excellent way to own stock for those interested in a long-term growth and are don't need the current income. They don't need the dividends to live off of. It allows the investor to take advantage of compounding automatically with normally no or very small transaction costs. The DRIP that I belong to with a group of other investors in the club I used to belong to, we would sometimes get hit with six cents. 6 cents, folks, or 9 cents, because it just cost them so very little to run this program, and they took the costs and they put them on you, but still, it was nothing. And investing in a company like General Electric or Johnson & Johnson or Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's company, in this way is almost like investing in a mutual fund, because mutual funds automatically reinvest the dividends and the capital gains back into the mutual fund. So you could think of stocks that are large companies that have many different divisions and many different companies within the company as a mutual fund. And a very, very great way to build wealth slowly over time. And so, do you remember the slide that showed you, a dozen years or 25 years or 16 years where the stock market basically, as measured by imperfect measurements that we talked about in the previous presentation, do you see how now we can have optimism during those long periods where the market, as people say, doesn't do anything, even though it went up and down like crazy? Right, we don't care about that. We simply buy high-quality companies on a periodic basis as the money comes in, $50, $100 more if we can afford it, and we allow the dividend reinvestment plans to reinvest the dividends in more shares, and we can make money even when the market doesn't do anything. How could you be so invested in stocks? They haven't done anything in 15 years. Oh, yes, they have. They've been paying me dividends. Okay, well, all right, enough for that. All right, so you see, as Mr. Rockefeller says, you know what gets me excited is when my dividend checks come in. Slide number 74. Let us end this third presentation of Chapter 5 with the introduction to price-to-earnings ratio. Now, we've already discussed price-to-earnings ratio a little bit, and I told you you wouldn't understand. That was back in Chapter 4. And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about this puppy, folks, because this is the most watched stock market statistic. The price divided by the earnings, the P-E ratio, sometimes written as P/E, sometimes just written as P-E. It's a very simple calculation, and again, you're going to learn how to do it, but you just look it up. Price divided by earnings per share. So if we go back to the previous example, and we had $20 price and $2 earnings per share, that would be 20 divided by 2, or 10. Now, don't put dollar sign, don't put a percent sign. It is unit list. So just put the number. But if you know, a lot of you put the dollar sign or the percent sign, don't do it. 10 PE. Now, is that high? Is that low? Well, traditionally, stocks sold for our P.E. ratios of 5 to 15, 5 to 14, 7 to 14. And a P.E. of 20 was only reserved for the fastest growing stocks. Well, during the 1980s and 90s and in the late 1920s and then late 1960s, P.E.s that were higher of 20 were not unusual. And then when the organic matter hits the ventilating device, the P.E.s come down drastically. And in the 2008 turmoil, P/E ratios came down greatly. So we will discuss P/E in much more detail. What you know for now is that it's price divided by earnings per share. That's the calculation I'm going to ask you to do, one or two. It's not that hard to do on the worksheet number two. Is it worksheet number two? And typically was 5 to 15, but more and more you see 14, 15, 16. I'm going to ask you to look at this up, right? And then for fast-growing companies, above 20, okay? When we come back, we'll finish up Chapter 5 with discussing the different types of common stocks and some strategies for investing. Study hard, folks. I know it's a lot of material, but you've got to do it every day. Listen to the presentations, watch the presentations, read the book, make notes for yourself, and study, because it takes repetition. There are some people who once they hear something, once they read something, boom, they have it. I ain't one of them, and there are not that many of them. It's less than 10% of a population, usually, sometimes up, depends on the population, but usually it's less than 10% of the population. All of us regular people must repeat, must study, and that's how you learn. Do well, folks. Study hard and bring honor and glory to Southwestern Community College. See you in the next and final presentation of Chapter 5.